This is Jim Wallace of Sojourners, and you're listening to Jim Wallace in Conversation. It's a program about faith and justice, or as I like to say, the moral choices behind the headlines. I'm speaking today with the author, Margaret Atwood. You've probably heard of her book, The Handmaid's Tale, which has been adapted now into a smash TV hit series on Hulu. You can also hear the audio version of that book right here on Audible. In addition to publishing some 40 works of fiction and nonfiction, Margaret Atwood is also published in our own Sojourners magazine. She thinks widely about the nature of belief, the nature of politics, the nature of our relationships to each other, and about nature itself. What are our duties to each other and the planet? So I'm honored to welcome Margaret Atwood today to our program.
Happy to be here.
Let's start with your Handmaid's Tale, which has so resonated anew in the Trump era and with this new Hulu TV series as well. Why do you think that's happened? Why has it so resonated?
It resonates because it seems more real now than it did when I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote it in 1984, and I started it in West Berlin when the Cold War wall was still up. So it's been a while, and you would have thought that it would have gotten less relevant. But instead, it has become more relevant because more people have achieved power who would actually like to do some of these things.
Well, your depiction of this brutal patriarchal theocracy in Gilead makes some think the book is anti-religious, but you say no. You distinguish between purportedly religious, I love that phrase, in order to gain power, and the core values and principles of faith which you resonate with. Say more about that.
Yes, well, this is a very, very old motif in world history. And one of my rules for Handmaid's Tale was I wasn't going to put anything into it that did not have precedence in real life. So there's an interesting book called The Evolution of God, which points out that with religions, their times of more tolerance is before they have achieved total power. And their times of less tolerance is when they feel they've got the upper hand. And this is not a question of any one particular religion. It just seems to be how human groups behave, and it doesn't even have to be a religion. It could be a state system, you know, the USSR under Stalin, for example. So let's say an ideology, a public thing that people are supposed to say they believe in and to which they're expected to conform. When there are a number of them sharing space, which is what the fathers of the U.S. Were hoping for, they were hoping for religious toleration in which many religions could exist side by side without killing one another. When you have many, you're more likely to achieve a state of peaceful coexistence. So my question to myself was, if the United States were to become a totalitarianism, under what slogan, motto, or system would they choose to do that? And it would not be communism. You would not be able to get the requisite 33% on your side if you said, hey, guys, let's do communism. It wouldn't overtly be Nazism. It wouldn't call itself that. It would be more likely to go back to the roots of New England and have something like a 17th century Puritan theocracy. So I do stress Puritan. You don't notice people having a lot of fun in this society.
So they would use religion or use the language.
Yeah, absolutely is religion, and it's been done lots before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when I published the book, I got three different reactions in three different English-speaking markets. In the UK, they said, jolly good yarn. So they were talking about the story qualities. because they felt that they'd done their Puritan totalitarian theocracy under Oliver Cromwell and that they weren't about to do it again. In Canada, they nervously said, as Canadians are always nervously saying, could it happen here? And sometimes they said, why is Canada the place people escape to? I say, because Canada is the place people escape to in real life.
That's right.
But in the United States, even then, in 1985, they were saying, how much time do we have?
So it's amazing to watch, I think, like my young staff, a new generation that probably didn't read your book in 1984. Interesting year to write this book.
They weren't born.
That's right. So now the TV series and the book is attracting a younger audience. How are they seeing or responding differently, would you say?
Well, they sometimes don't get the references because they weren't born yet, though there is that handy section at the back that names a number of places where these things happened in real life. In other words, where I got them from. However, they're responding quite viscerally because they've been watching events unfold. And for instance, the Texas legislature was meeting, group of all men, passing laws about women's reproductive rights. And a number of women dressed as handmaids chose to sit there quietly while they were doing it. There's a photograph of them surrounded by men with guns that looks like a still from the Handmaid's Tale television series. It's uncanny. And I think they also, the younger generation, also gets it that there's more than one way of interpreting certain sections of the Gospels. For instance, in the 17th century, people took a strange turn. By their fruits ye shall know them. Originally, you would have to think meant spiritual fruits, but they took it to mean material fruits. In other words, if you were rich, that meant you were virtuous. Try that on for size. And that is the story that often gets put out there these days. But if you go back to the original meaning, it's not talking about how much money you have. It's talking about how you behave.
Now, before this, we had this conversation started, we're talking about this topic of debt. Now, I think it's very interesting. You were asked to give these lectures in Canada, great honor to be asked, and you chose to talk about debt. And the timing of this turned out to be quite relevant. It came right at the beginning, 2008, of the crash, the financial crash. You had decided this before the crash, but these lectures became a best-selling book, Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth. How did a literary figure like you decide to do lectures across the country on debt?
Well, I was a Victorianist as well as being an American literature and civilization person. And when you read Victorian novels and you're 18, you think they're about romance, like who marries whom. But when you go on a little further in your life, you realize that name any Victorian novel, there's an underpinning of money. Like who has the money? In what way do they have the money? Is it old money or is it new money? Does it come from a questionable source? How are people earning the money? It was the early days of capitalism, and people didn't quite understand things like stocks and shares. So you could be wiped out. I can think of two novels in which that happens. One is Cranford, and the other one is Anne of Green Gables. You could be wiped out suddenly, just as people were wiped out suddenly in October 2008, through forces that you didn't understand. And you could also get into a lot of trouble by borrowing money that you couldn't pay back, because then you'd end up in debtor's prison. And this is the foundation of Charles Dickens's entire life's work, because that happened to his father, and it left a scar on his young life. So that was very much on their minds. And nobody that I knew about had had written about it. So that's one of the chapters in Payback. But another chapter has to do with the religious foundations for the idea of spiritual debt and spiritual redemption and how far back that goes. And at the very beginning of the book, I talk about the experiments done with primates that show that they know when they're not getting their fair share. So what is fair sharing? Who do we owe things to? What is owed to whom and why? Then we get to the final one, which is about the balances in nature and what happens if you overdraw that particular account too much.
I want to get back to that one in particular, but you turn, by bringing in history and literature and religion into all this, you turn a grim and often boring topic like debt into a historical study about human relationships, human nature, nature itself, the need for reciprocity and equilibrium in everything from finances to the environment. Reciprocity and equilibrium. Say more about that.
Well, just to put it in context, it seems that the societies that are the happiest are those in which there is a smaller gap between rich people and everybody else. And the United States was like that. It was a lot more like that in the 50s. There wasn't this huge chasm between the very, very, very wealthy and everybody else, and particularly middle class. You know, the middle class has been under siege for a while now. Think of osmosis. When you have osmosis, you have, say, a saline solution on one side of a membrane and fresh water on the other, and it's a permeable membrane, and enough flows through so that it achieves a state of balance. And although you're not going to get that in a complex society like ours, you're probably going to need a bit more of it unless you want the French Revolution in some form.
So this, as you know, is very biblical with the whole Jubilee tradition. Leviticus 25 talks about...
You're supposed to pay off your... Yes, I think I put that in the book.
Yeah.
You're supposed to pay off your debts. We're not sure that that ever happened, but it was supposed to have... It was supposed to happen.
It was supposed to happen, and it's... Well, it's Hebrew scriptures, and Jesus talks about that even in his opening sermon. He talks about the year of the Lord, which is this, where every 50 years a trumpet would sound, and that people were supposed to, those who had lost land and now were in debt or slaves or in jail, could return to their land. It was a changing of land, labor, and capital in a way that was supposed to be a regular adjustment to bring about the equilibrium that you're talking about.
Yeah, and as I say, we're not sure that it ever happened,
right.
But it's very interesting that the idea was there. And every major religion has said, you need to minister to the poor. You need to take care of the poor people. You need to take care of the widows and orphans. And that is in the Old Testament, and it's in the Gospels, and it is certainly a motif in the Muslim religion, and it is a motif in Buddhism as well. It just seems to be something that human beings have been cognizant of, that you need to take care, if you are having an inclusive kind of society, you need to take care of the people on the bottom end.
And indeed, as you know, there was a campaign that many of us got involved in Britain called Jubilee 2000, which applied the Jubilee principle to the beginning of a new millennium to cancel the bilateral debt of the poorest countries in the world.
And
it was a
did
successful,
that happen?
Yes, it was a successful campaign, and Bono and others joined in, and it was a faith-based campaign all over the world, and it ended in the ending of bilateral debt. This is from the rich nations to the poorest nations, and Gordon Brown, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time, actually said that people like he and Bill Clinton and Tony Blair wouldn't have forgiven these bilateral debts were it not for this faith-based movement called Jubilee 2000, which really did change the debt structure. And it was based on this biblical tradition of Jubilee at the beginning of the new millennium. And it was all around what you're saying about equilibrium and balance. To restore the balance was just something we have to try and do. And when it gets so far off balance, when Oxfam reports that 400 people in the world have more wealth than the whole rest of the world, something has gone wrong, and that balance has to be restored again. Now, let's talk about that last chapter on ecological debt. A big issue I know in your head and heart these days is the environment, being stewards of the earth, and climate change and the threats that poses, the direction we're heading now. How does your last chapter speak to how this is an ecological debt that we have to pay back?
Well, everything we have and eat and drink and breathe and make comes from nature. So it comes from the planet that we live on. And climate change is rather vague. I think that's one reason that some people have trouble getting their heads around it. But if we put it in slightly different terms and say, if the oceans are killed, and that has to do with a warming climate, if the oceans are killed, in particular, if the marine algaes are killed, the amount of oxygen that we have to breathe will sadly diminish, and it will probably be the end of us. It will not be the end of life. Plants will do fine, but we are not plants, and it will probably be all right for quite small animals because they don't need as much oxygen as we do. But should we kill the oceans, I'd say goodbye us. So if you really feel that you should love your neighbor, you're going to have to give some consideration to your neighbor's oxygen supply and your neighbor's fresh water supply and your neighbor's toxin-free food. One of the other big threats facing us is the amount of plastic that's getting into the water supply because the chemicals leaching out of it are causing sea life to diminish. A lot of them are estrogen imitating, so therefore you're going to get less reproduction. And we have noticed that effect already also in human beings who are living in pretty plastic-saturated and chemical-saturated environments. So again, if you want a human race, maybe you should start thinking about it now. I won't be around, but a lot of the people listening will be.
There's a lovely commentary there that you just did. I would say theologically, to love your neighbor as yourself means to love your neighbor as oxygen, water, and food, as much as you love your own. That's a very good commentary.
Every time you breathe, you're breathing in the environment. So you're going to have to regard oxygen in the atmosphere as a common good.
Your last chapter, which I think is a very powerful read, I recommend to all our listeners here, reminded me of a scripture. Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 19 says, I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Now choose life, that you and your children may live. And you talk about choices all the way through your chapter. What are the choices that we have to make to choose life?
The choices that we need to make are choices that are going to increase the planet's chances of getting through the already looming changes in the environment that we're seeing now, and getting the human race through what may turn out to be yet another bottleneck. So if you have a warming planet, you're going to have more torrential rainstorms because what goes up has to come down. You get more evaporation, you get more torrential rainstorms. You get stronger winds because warming creates updrafts, and when you have updrafts like that, other air has to rush in to fill the gap, so you're going to get stronger storms. You're going to get moving areas of drought. What's going to be drier is going to move around. All of that will have an impact on the food supply. And when you have an impact on the food supply, especially in poorer countries, people start thinking they have nothing to lose. And that's when you get civil wars and wars. So it's not me saying this. It's the Pentagon, that one of the greatest threats to global peace and security is climate change. Can we technologically invent ourselves out of our problems?
Right.
Not entirely, but somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big movement to get solar cookers into the hands, particularly of poorer people in southern countries. And you can cook without wood, coal, or gas, or any of those things. And that would take a huge burden off infrastructure and the kinds of energy supplies that we've been relying on recently.
We had some bishops from Africa come into a meeting here, and they told that story about solar cookers, also about how solar panels are allowing them to have electricity, places there'd never be grids going into at all. And now kids are able to study their homework at night. Women can have children in the light and not just in the darkness of nights. And they called their whole campaign, these bishops, "Let There Be Light." It was a very powerful
thing. Wasn't
that
wonderful?
And you talk in an interview at Sojourners about how you think the faith communities have to step up and be a real force to help stop climate change, because you say they have some leverage. What kind of leverage do faith communities have to really help move us in a new direction?
Well, if faith communities that actually do believe that love your neighbor means loving your neighbor's air and food supply, if those people can get mobilized, they already have a powerful structure, and they are already showing leaders. For instance, the new Pope is on this side. So you can get a number of people, really a large number of people, moving in that direction, and that can make a huge impact. I think a lot more people of faith are understanding that their view of what moral behavior is has to be broader than it has been in recent years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have, in our conversations lately, I can just feel and sense this deep passion in you for this question, for the earth, for turning ourselves around here. So putting it in your chapter on debt, I mean, your book on debt, having a whole chapter on ecological debt, really made a strong statement about broadening and deepening our notion beyond just finances. That it's our relationship to each other, but also to the earth itself. That was a very powerful thing, powerful way to end the book, I thought.
We all kind of get it when it comes to, I've done you a favor, you owe me one. I've lent you some money, you owe it back.
Mm-hmm.
But I've exterminated 90% of the fish population of the ocean. Okay, because that's what we've done. Who owes what to whom?
Let's talk about this issue of hope. Elizabeth Moss, the actor who played your main character in the new series on Handmaid's Tale, says this, "But it's also been very important to us to show the hope that exists. At the heart of the story is a woman who has had everything taken away from her, her family, daughter, friends, rights, freedom, everything. But she will not give up." What would you say young people are coming and saying to you? Are you hopeful? Why should we be hopeful? Where do we find hope? You know?
I think it might be a good idea to start a site called the Blog of Hope, in which you would put on nothing but hopeful news items. The other thing I say to young people is choose a goal for yourself that's manageable, even if it's just raising monarch butterflies in your backyard. It's something you can actually accomplish. And that does make people feel hopeful, and it also makes them feel hopeful if they are a member of a group of any kind in which the people are working to accomplish the same goals that they are.
So are you feeling hopeful?
I always feel hopeful.
Do you?
Oh, yes, I do. I think it's just congenital. But I'm also tracking stories that I find quite hopeful. I like stories about people like Mr. Trash Wheel. Mr. Trash Wheel is up and operating in Baltimore Harbor. It's a boat with a big paddle wheel on it, and it's solar powered, and it's scooping all of the floating plastic up and doing away with it before it gets into the ocean. And I've also joined the Science Fiction Advisory Board of the X Prizes. The X Prizes are one of Richard Branson's things in which people are stimulated to invent things that are good for humanity and the planet. The other thing that you can do if you're feeling very overwhelmed is just to keep a journal of what is happening every day. Because sometime in the future, someone is going to be looking back at this period of ours and wondering how people who were there then at that moment, what they were recording and what they were feeling. A couple of years ago, there was a project that was initiated that resonated around the world, and it is the Future Library of Norway project. It's the brainchild of an artist called Katie Patterson. With this project, they planted a forest in Norway that will grow for 100 years. And in every year of that 100 years, a different writer will be asked to submit a manuscript in a sealed box. So the boxes will accumulate for 100 years. Nobody will know what's inside them. It has to be made of words, no images. But it could be anything. It could be a poem, it could be a message, it could be a novel, it could be a play, it could be a memoir, as long as it's made of words. So the boxes accumulate, and on the 100th year, all of the boxes are opened, and enough trees are cut from the forest to print the Future Library of Norway anthology. And I was the first one. And we got a lot of response from around the world because it is such a hopeful project. It assumes that there will be people in 100 years, that there will be a Norway, that the forest will grow, that there will be the library in Norway, that people will still know how to read, that people will still want to read, and that all will happen as is planned. And that is just an amazingly large number of hopeful assumptions to make. One of my feelings about writing is that all writing is hopeful, no matter what the content, because it assumes a future reader, even if the reader is yourself 5 years from now.
So you're Canadian. You live right north of us. I grew up in Detroit. Ontario was right next door across the river. Do you have any last word for us as a neighbor? I've not heard anybody talk about building a wall between the U.S. and Canada.
Well, we make jokes about it.
Yeah, sure.
No, we're not talking about building a wall. In fact, when I'm in the States, I say, you want to come to Canada? Welcome. We'll have a cup of tea for you and some nice mattresses in the cellar, because Canada has been historically a place that people escape to. So when people say to me, well, what should Canada be doing right now? I say, well, Canada should be trying to maintain itself as a place that people can escape to.
So what is a good neighbor from Canada? What advice do you have for your neighbor to the South, America?
Oh, America, live up to your best idea of yourself. Don't give up on yourself. Don't succumb to the worst idea of yourself.
Thank you so much. It's been a delight to talk to you today. And I'm always going to be watching what you are thinking and doing and writing when you get out of bed in the morning. So keep doing that.
When I get out of bed in the morning, where's my coffee? That's what I'm writing. Right, okay. And coffee, that's a whole other problem. It's so lovely to talk to you, and I look forward to seeing you.
Yeah. Margaret Atwood is a great storyteller, and it's wonderful just to listen to her. I think part of what makes her novels so successful is that they tell compelling stories, stories that reveal the content of history and the choices, often moral choices, that people are making in history. She presses us to do that. That's worth a ponder. What are the choices we can make or not make in our own historical moment? I respond deeply to that because this show is about the choices beneath the news and the political headlines and how those choices will determine the outcome of history. And that's what Atwood is trying to tell us. Of course, Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale is coming back with a gusto in the Trump era because the things that are happening in her story seem more possible or real or relevant now. And I think she is cautioning us against accepting such circumstances, or you might say normalizing a political regime like this one. I am quite impressed by Margaret Atwood's current passion about protecting the earth. She says we can't love our neighbor unless we love our neighbor's oxygen, their clean air. Now that's a gospel commentary, if I've ever heard one. So how would you describe this historical moment and your part in it? What are the choices that we and you need to make in our time? In the crisis of this moment, is it just a danger or is there an opportunity? I think there is a Trump opportunity here, a chance for us to go deeper. Number one, into what we mean by faith. Number two, into our relationship with each other. That's critical across all our boundaries. And three, into our relationship to the poor, as Atwood reminds us, all of our traditions call us to. And let's add, as Atwood would have us do, go deeper into our relationship with the earth, with this planet that we live on and need every single day. Our program is produced by Kitty Isley and engineered by Paul Woody Woodhull. The executive producer is Lee Hernandez. Thanks to Eric Newsom, Senior Vice President of Original Content Development for Audible. I'm Jim Wallace. I hope you'll come back to join me here next time for Jim Wallace in Conversation.